To another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Well, it's been that kind of week. It's been such a great week that I just looked at the email I sent to sent Stan, said we were going to be live from 1 to 3 p.m. today, so I'm hoping that his work in quantum physics allows him to time travel with me, because apparently, I'm a crazy person. Sorry about that. And so let's see, anything good happened this week, Bill, that we need to announce?
No.
That's a hard pass.
Not in my world.
They put the Rocky statue in the museum it was standing outside of now.
Are you kidding?
Finally, yeah, after like 40 years.
What museum?
It's in Philadelphia. I don't know the name of the museum, but it had been out there as a prop for 40 years. They finally put it in the museum.
Well, there you go.
That's the best thing I can think of.
Thanks, Alex. That's an auspicious beginning. We had nothing. Oh, we had nothing. So our guest today is always part of the trio that we interview about the gas issue. The problem is, you know, that infamous character, Silent Sam? Well, we mostly have Silent Stan. And so he doesn't ever say very much. And I'm like, I know he knows all sorts of things. So we arm-twisted him into spending some time with us today so we could learn about the world through Stan's perspective. Because I'm going to do the back half of his bio, because that's the part I don't usually read. It's always a ton of information on everyone. But Stan Ellis began his career in Kern County in the oil industry in 1975 as a mud engineer. First question, I want to know what that is, before forming his first company in 1981. After his company found success, Stan entered the chemical process industry to minimize waste from oil refineries. He has since founded a quantum physics lab, as well as a company that works with the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense to advance cybersecurity in the U.S. Want to know about that? His work in quantum physics, sort of want to know about that in a scary, what does that do sort of way. That includes innovations in quantum communication, quantum networking, and the development of revolutionary medical research and treatment using quantum entanglement. As a member of the Cal State University Bakersfield Engineer Advisory Board, Stan is invested in the education and growth of the next generation. Why, you ask? Because he has a family spanning 5 children, 20 grandchildren, 4 great-grandchildren. So Stan's leaving the future in good hands. He's motivated by a profound sense of duty to future generations, and for that reason, he bit the bullet and agreed to serve in the California Assembly, State Assembly, in the 32nd Assembly District. And I'm sure that's been illuminating for him. But we continually talk about the California issue with fuel. Then the Iran war came. Everybody else's fuel prices kind of went up. And the world is busy blaming that for the California fuel prices. However, we were talking about California fuel prices with you based on Stan and Professor Miche and Mike Ariza last year. So this isn't new. And I'm sure we will talk about that in the latest updates and stuff. But we have not talked to Stan about the, you know, people don't know. You know, there's oil and then there's gas and there's some magic that happens in the middle. And I think the biggest education we've all gotten is watching Land Man, which is probably not good.
No.
It's a little like beef. We all know that meat doesn't come from the store, that there are cows in a field, and then some other stuff happens, and some people know about that middle ground. But the oil business is really a very, it's a very complex and multi-layered process, and it has been absolutely demonized. And I guess that, on a serious note, I'd like to undemonize that today. And I figured you were just the guy to do it.
Well, thank you, Aaron and Bill, for having me on. I did want to tell you that the reason I really don't speak too much is there's a verse in the Bible in Proverbs that says, even an ignorant man can look in trouble if he keeps his mouth shut. And there are so many areas that I don't know anything about. And I try to give respect to my colleagues. You know, Professor Mache, like last week, he is so intelligent and has done such a great job of articulating the data and delivering the data. It's hard to speak when he's speaking because he is so good at what he does. And then the same thing with Mike Ariza. Mike, you know, Mike worked in these process units in the refinery. He has hands-on experience. I'll tell you what, you can't take hands-on experience away from anybody. And that's kind of how I got started in the oil and gas sector.
Yeah, what's a mud engineer? What does that mean?
Well, so when you drill for oil and gas, you have a drill bit, and it has like three nozzles in it, and these sharp cones, and it rotates. And it's hooked to hollow pipes, and you circulate this fluid you pump it down hole while you're drilling, and it carries up the cuttings and it stabilizes the well bore. And it's a whole science. There are many different types of drilling fluids or mud, oil-based, there's water-based, there's polymer-based, there's many, many different types. So depending on the formation that you're drilling through requires different types of drilling fluids. And obviously it's been pretty well defined in the last 50 years, but when I broke out 50 years ago, not every area had been drilled, so sometimes you'd use the wrong drilling fluid. So we formulated those drilling fluids and serviced the oil and gas sector. So that's what a drilling mud engineer was.
Well, that's, you know, things you don't think about in industry. And when you started in this was... I'm kind of assuming oil was demonized for a long time. Was it such a big deal, you know, from the environmental sector that oil is terrible and we have to get rid of it, blah, blah, blah? Was that a narrative at that time?
No, it was not. It was, to quote our president, it was drill, baby, drill. We were dependent on oil and gas. The industry was growing. Absolutely, absolutely not. It's not been demonized until the last 10, 15 years. And then you see these environmental groups that profit off of, they profit off of being negative and raising money and telling everybody that oil and gas is bad. And it's propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, because I remember one program you listed some of the things that are the offshoot of oil. You know, without oil, we don't have those things.
Yeah, 6,000 items, by the way.
Hey, I want to jump in really quick, please. So petroleum-based products like Vaseline, should you be putting those on your skin?
That's random.
There you go. Good comeback. Tell the greenies that. I tell the folks in Sacramento, if you don't like oil and gas, then don't drive your car. Don't drive an electric car, which is 100, you've got to drive it 122,000 miles because it's to become carbon neutral because of all the plastics, the polymers, the copolymers in plastics, the styrene, butyrene in your tires, which is an oil derivative, the rims that were forged by oil and gas. Don't give me that crap.
Yeah.
So this whole green agenda has put us exactly, thanks Bill for that, right exactly where we are today.
That was Alex.
Yeah.
That was Alex.
No, I just heard that
there are three of us in here.
The petroleum-based pharmaceuticals, do they have a negative effect on the human body?
No. These things have been tested for 50 years, and I can tell you, but I can tell you there are derivatives, they call them BTEXs, benzene, toluene, xylene. These solvents are used in heavy industry, and those are carcinogenic, and they've been proven carcinogenic. But there are also derivatives of oil and gas that are not, And they've been formulated such that it helps the, it helps us. It's good for us.
Well, isn't that awkward? So, I know this is, I don't know, maybe we can't quantify this, but who's the big hater in the oil industry? Like, who tipped that over? Was there a front runner at some point?
You know, Mike, you might address that. This Center for Biological Diversity, and I'm telling you, there's 20 of them out there. Every time there's something that comes up in a Natural Resources Committee, there's 20 or 30 of them that add on.
Sure.
They're always the same. And you actually have to wonder, where do they get their money? How are they funded?
Typically lawsuits through the Equal Access for Justice Act. That's been fairly lucrative for them. Because I was thinking about the guy that Patrick Moore, who started Greenpeace, and he bailed on Greenpeace after they did the whale thing because the people at Greenpeace wanted to ban chlorine. And he was like, you can't do that. That's actually an element. And they couldn't figure that out, so he left.
The Sierra Club's another one.
Sierra Club.
Center for Biological Diversity. It goes on and on and on. It's like, and there's like, I don't know, I see 20 or 30 of them. I'm like, where do these people get their money? It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, and people donate to them because they think they're saving the planet. Just out of curiosity, in the legislature, because I'm sure they're after you all the time there, when they come in, what's the, we have to get rid of it because, what's their...
Oh, because it's dirty. So I'll give you an example. I'm on the Natural Resources Committee, and a assembly member wanted to put forth a bill that would invoice and charge all oil and gas companies retroactively for the greenhouse gas
emissions. Oh, boy.
Okay?
Mm.
So they have what's called a subject matter expert that testifies. And this subject matter expert says, we have, oil is dirty, and we have asthma attacks, and we have cancer, and we have all of the things. So, and based on volatile organic compounds, so I get to ask a question. I said, can you tell me if, in your neighborhood, if volatile organic compounds are in the atmosphere, or is your air particulate matter? The answer was, I don't know. But you're telling me, scientifically, that oil is dirty because of this and this and this, but you can't prove it. All I hear out of the greenies are, oh, it's causing asthma, it's causing cancer, it's causing... Show me the data. There's no data. It's all rhetoric. It's all rhetoric, and it's not science-based. It's so frustrating.
And when you were in industry prior, I mean, how long have you been in the assembly? It's been like last year, right? You haven't had to...
Yep.
You got Shanghai doing a balance of term thing?
Pretty much.
I was going to say, how long have you been a hostage of the state legislature, but... So prior to that, in actual business... What was your interaction with, I mean, you had tons of interaction with regulatory, I'm sure.
Yes.
But with the protest crowd, with the, Center for Biological Diversity and the Sierra Club and all that, did they cross your path much?
No, Aaron, because most of my work was, I worked in the service chemical process business for refineries and the oil fields, and I was really kind of removed from that because I was servicing the oil company. I did live through the overregulation, and it's still living through that today in my companies. But I never had much to do with the environmental groups. I never seen any protests. I was always out in the field working.
Yeah, that makes sense. probably a great way to keep your sanity, I would think.
Yeah.
Especially when you work in an industry that provides, you know, the professor has said multiple times that this is the first 8, or maybe it's you, I forget, the first 8% of the economy all starts with oil, and without that, you don't have the other 92%.
Exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so kind of what I wanted to relay to your folks, your listeners today, was the simple fact that, you know, California is its own island. We, just because of Iran, we didn't end up with these high gas prices. How convenient for this administration in California to also, of course they blame Trump for everything anyway,
right.
But how convenient. But what most people don't know, and thanks to your show, by the way, for getting us out there, is that because the greenies and because of CEQA and because of all the regulation and because of CalGEM not issuing permits, our production is down from 600,000 barrels a day to 250. Well, therefore, now we have to import oil. If we'd have kept that production up there where it should have been, we wouldn't have a problem. And we wouldn't have a price spike. And then, because these refiners are paying, having to pay $150 to $200 million a year because of cap and trade, there's no profit. Why should they stay in business? I don't blame them a bit. Shut down. Go ahead and shut down. If you want our green agenda, then shut the refinery down. I don't blame them. Shame on our legislature and shame on our state government for putting us in this position and not having forward thinking. They wanted this green gas agenda, greenhouse gas agenda, and all electric. What a joke. Nobody thought far enough ahead that we didn't even have the electrical infrastructure. And let alone the consumption has not gone down in gas and diesel.
That's always
the consumption doesn't. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, that's always the inconvenient part of it. That the more they lean on people, the more people are like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I want to do that or not. Let's take a really quick break and we'll come back. Stan, I like it when you're on a rant. So,
sorry.
No, I do. I like it. I'm actually not teasing you. I do like it, and I knew there was a rant in there, and I'm excited that we're gonna get that on the list of things that people can listen to. You're listening to We the People Radio, and you can find all this stuff about the oil and gas if you specifically go to gascrisis.org. Otherwise, you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Okay, that was a good lead-in for you, Bill. Bill was having a rant on the commercial break.
Well, you know, you were talking about the war on oil. It doesn't just affect the refineries and the drillers and, you know, the people that are directly involved in the production. How about all the businesses that use those products? They have just about regulated those people out of the state because, for an example, we have a repair shop. We use oil. We change oil. That oil gets put in a storage container to be hauled off when the container's full. And the rule says when it's picked up, they put a pickup date on it. So, and then you have to write a start date on that barrel or tank or whatever, a start date for when you first start adding oil back to that container. Well, I had two containers. I was inspected last week. I had two containers that were about half full. They were emptied and had a pickup date on them of about 2 months ago. But I failed to write the start date on those containers when we started adding oil to them.
Ooh.
Now, obviously, that oil hasn't been in there for more than 2 months. I can keep it for 180 days. He still wrote me a citation because it didn't have a pickup or didn't have a start date on it, even though I could have just wrote a start date on it. Oh, no, it's got oil. It's got oil in the container and there's no start date. That's a citation. Well, you lean on the users of petroleum enough, they're going to leave. And this is, I think, an extension of the war on petroleum products. You have the bureaucracy out there making money off the backs of businesses that don't comply to every little detail of all these rules they've put in place, even though they don't really make any sense. I'm done.
Period.
Period.
I have a story. Many, many, many stories, but I'll leave you with this one. I had two chemical process jobs in the Los Angeles Basin under the South Coast Air Quality Management District. I had two catalytic oxidizers that for vapor recovery of my separation processes. And we had two identical pieces of equipment. But when we got our permit conditions, we didn't catch it. But one piece was to be monitored for manually every 4 hours, and the other one was at 2 hours. My guys didn't catch it. They thought we monitored both at 4 hours. It came out 6 months later and gave us a fine for $825,000.
Oh.
And we weren't even putting out any more emissions.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to fight like the dickens to get that reduced. But that is exactly the Gestapo mentality of CARB, and that's exactly where we're at today.
Oh, sure. Well, in my situation, I had two barrels and out of, I don't know how many I had out there, but two of them didn't have start dates on them. Rather than write me a citation for that, oh, no, there's two barrels, there's two citations. Again, Gestapo. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yep. How much will that cost?
Well, it won't cost anything this time because that makes me a tier two violator. So there's no fine this time. But if they ever come back again and find that I haven't written a start date, then that makes me a tier one violator forever. I can never like be good for 10 years and go back to zero. I'm forever a tier one violator, and a tier one violation will be anywhere from $1,000 to $10,000 per violation.
So bottom line is, if I get pulled over for speeding or some other infraction, I have to confess that I'm sleeping with a tier two violator.
Oh yeah, you could be marked for life.
You should have some buttons made.
I'll give you another really quick story. One of the auto parts,
full disclosure,
big chain auto parts places here in California, that, you know, all your auto parts suppliers sell oil. You know, you walk in, hey, I need a quart of oil for my car. They sell you a quart of oil. You go out in the parking lot, you dump it in your car. Well, hey, there's a dumpster across the way. I throw the empty container in the dumpster. Waste management picks up those dumpsters, and if they find one oil container in that dumpster that they can tip and any oil runs out of it, even a tiny little stream of oil comes out of that, you're in violation. And this particular auto parts store, I won't name them, waste management dumped their dumpster not once, but three different times, and each time, because now all your garbage trucks have cameras in them, so they can see what's being dumped into those trucks from the dumpsters. They saw empty oil containers being dumped. They pulled around the corner, got in their dumpster, pulled those oil containers out, and they streamed oil. They waited until they caught them three different times. Now, this isn't a company putting those in. This is customers walking across the parking lot and dumping it in the dumpster. They caught them three different times, fine, $1 million. And they didn't even know they were in violation.
Because it was the general public who was putting the
It was
container.
The public. So now they've got to go out and put padlocks on their dumpsters so you can't, you know, put anything in a dumpster they don't know about. Again, that should have been a warning, or you know, to just turn around and fine them $1 million. Who do you think's paying for that?
Yeah.
The next time you go in for a spark plug in that place, it's not a dollar and a half; it's $3.50 because they got to make up that $1 million.
Sure, it's Trump's fault though.
Well, I'm sure he was probably one of them putting the oil in there. Yeah.
Let's just not lose sight. Let's not lose sight of that.
Yeah, it's car, yeah. and it's just the ridiculousness of their enforcement and their rules on this stuff. I mean, I don't think we should be gross polluters or anything like that, but I mean, let's have some common sense.
Although you are a tier two violator,
I am a tier two violator.
I'm going to use that all day.
If I had my way, we would all. You know, we all need regulation, right?
Sure.
We all need discipline. We do all want clean air, and we want clean water. If I had my way, because you have new people starting in business all the time, and you have all of these, I don't know, there's, what do we have, 420,000 regulations in the state of California?
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, oh, Lord.
Whatever the number is. But these regulators should educate us, not fine us. They should come out. And they should say, here's the law, here's why you should do this. And they should do that several times because, unfortunately, there are some blatant people that don't follow the law. And they're the ones that should be fined, not the good guys. But our whole system is set up. They come out, they see the lid off the gas tank, automatically comes off the line. No, they should say, look, you guys, you need to keep those lids on those gas tanks. And if they come out two or three or four times and you don't, then you should get a fine. But
sure.
They should educate, not fine.
Right. Well, another thing they do, too, is a lot of times they don't go after the small guy, you know, because they're not going to get much money for them. They always go after the big players, the ones that have very large shops, that have a big turnover. Because they can get money out of them, and a lot of times they settle. They'll say, "Hey, I'm gonna fine you $1 million for that violation." Whoa, wait a minute! And they dicker back and forth, and they end up taking, you know, $100,000. Which
I think
if they went to court, they probably wouldn't have to pay that, but it cost them that much to defend themselves, and they know that,
right.
So they pick a high number, and negotiate it down so they can pay their little cronies to run around their cars and basically harass business.
Dig through the dumpster.
That's exactly what they do.
So, Stan, this is all predicated on the fact that oil is a toxic. I mean, we wouldn't have to be this hypervigilant if it wasn't a super scary substance that's incredibly toxic and probably going to kill us all. Right?
Except it came out of the ground.
Yeah, right.
Here's the way I look at this. We in California got the cleanest oil and gas in the world. From the wellhead, we captured the emissions, the volatile organic compounds, and the pipelines the same way, and the refiners the same way. We put out the cleanest oil and gas in the world. There are very, very little pollutants that ever come out of the production and the refining of oil and gas. It's clean. The rub is when you put it in your car and you convert that gasoline to, you know, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide. Those things are are really not very healthy for you. And that's the problem. People don't realize it's not oil and gas. It's what's coming out your tailpipe. And we have reduced our emissions enormously through clean burning technology. But also, we have CO2 sequestration. What do you think plants live on? They need CO2. So it's not like there's this full circle. Let's talk about emissions. Let's talk about the high-speed rail. We're spending billions, $120 billion on this high-speed rail. It's the biggest joke I've ever seen in my life. When you could put that into water infrastructure and have that water come into farming, and you'd have all the CO2 sequestration you ever needed for all of our future. But no, they won't think like that. All they want to do is the greenies want to get paid and paid and paid to call everything a pollutant.
Right.
Sorry.
No, you're absolutely right.
That's exactly it, because, you know, I don't know. They used to put, I remember when the shop back in the, well, that company is gone, where I met Bill in the equipment business, back in the 90s, they used to put oil on the ground in the parking lot to keep the dust down. Oops.
Sure.
Everybody did that. I mean, that was what we did.
That was really common.
What do you think asphalt is?
Yeah.
Well, then there's that, right?
Well, you want to hear some hypocrisy?
Okay.
In asphalt, I was trying to take some of the waste out of the refineries and dry it and convert it and put it as an asphalt filler, as a mastic asphalt. And it had polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons, benzene, phenanthracene, benzopyrene. Anyway, you had these 13 constituents that the EPA considered hazardous. Well, guess what's in asphalt? The same damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah.
So anyway, I never could get that done, but because of listed regulations. However, when asphalt hardens, nothing leaches through it. It doesn't go into the groundwater. Asphalt's asphalt. Then if you don't want oil and gas, don't drive on a road.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, another thing they do, too, in California, maybe it's not just California, but here, I'm going to say 6 years ago, California came out with a policy that if you sold anything in your store that was deemed to contain carcinogens, you had to put a sign on the wall or
right.
on the shelf or whatever
right.
that said you are selling a product that has been deemed hazardous to your health. Well, we had to stick these signs every 6 feet around our entire showroom because everything you sell is made of from oil.
I think it was Prop 64.
Yeah.
And I only remember that because I tried to buy something from Franklin Covey for my planner, and I couldn't get it shipped to California because it was deemed to be a carcinogen. It was made out of plastic.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Pretty much everything you touch is made.
So we have to take a really quick break. We're going to come right back. There's more ranting going, you know, in the future. I'm not even going to give you the decaf warning. I'm just not. Tom Lehrer wrote a song for us. It'll be the coming back song that I think just pretty much sums it all up from the environmentalist standpoint. And we're going to come back. Our guest is Stan Ellis. And you can find all sorts of stuff about Stan, his extended biography, et cetera, et cetera. And the other 7 interviews we've done with Stan and his partners in crime here about the gas situation at gascrisis.org. Meanwhile, we are at wethepeopleradio.us.
Fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. We will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.
I'm pretty sure that's what your inspection guy was listening to on his way to your store.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So, Stan, people in the industry, are they just, like, really and truly can't flee the scene fast enough, or?
Well, you know, Mike Ariza, you're on, aren't you?
He's in the cone.
Is Mike Ariza on?
He was. He's in the cone of silence now.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, he, in the drilling industry, for example, this 237 that was passed to help with this Kern County EIR, it helped with some permitting, but the problem is that all of our drilling contractors have left the state and all the trained personnel because everybody's at the damn tax conservancy in California. And Mike Ariza is experiencing the same thing in the refinery. If we try to bring that refinery up tomorrow, we're not inhibited by mechanics. We're inhibited by the people to operate it. And I'm telling you, if they gave us the green light, we could do everything we wanted to do tomorrow to get back to drilling and increase production and get our refineries up to capacity. We don't have the people. It's going to take some time. It's going to take a couple of years.
Well, and you have to convince people to come back to the state because you can't train them if there's no one here to train them. They can't start from scratch. And so, we talk about this all the time, and I think people are kind of coming around to the idea or the knowledge that we are a fuel island in California. So no pipelines coming in. So the idea of shortages, that's not fixed by turn on a spigot elsewhere and pump it to us. That doesn't solve our problem here.
Here's how we fix the problem. So I've been in business for 40 years, and every day you're solving problems. Here's how you fix the oil and gas shortage, the gas and jet fuel and diesel problem in California. You have companies in Texas load up product and bring it to California, regardless if it's a car bomb or reformulated or not. And you get through the crunch and the crisis until you get enough sustainability by drilling and getting refineries back up and producing our own. It's that simple. But what's going to have to happen is the CARB and the governor is going to have to sign an executive order to make that happen. But guess what? We won't have a crisis if he can do that. I'm trying to prevent a crisis. Okay, so you might put a little more sulfur out in the atmosphere, sulfur dioxide. So what? At least you don't have people waiting in gas lines. And what if you can't get an ambulance because it doesn't have fuel if you got a catastrophe somewhere?
Yeah.
We have got to have fuel.
Yep.
So that's my solution.
Yeah. Well, the paper that you guys did back in October about the national security implications, I mean, it's huge. Even simple stuff. I mean, jet fuel, you've obviously got to have for military readiness, but they're seeing spikes in airline tickets because of
today that one of the airlines is jacking their ticket prices 20% to offset the cost of fuel.
They're bound to cut 20,000 flights.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they're cutting flights as well. So, I don't know what the answer is.
So, in your industries, because there are multiple industries, how do you navigate this for the future? Like, how do you plan your business with this stuff hanging over your head?
I think it's really, really tough. I'm telling everybody that I know, told you go to make some closing comments, make sure your pantry's full of groceries, and make sure your car is full of fuel. Don't let it get below a quarter. But I'll tell you, I don't like to cry wolf, but it doesn't hurt anyway to keep your car full of gas.
And of
course. It doesn't hurt the pantry full. What if there's another catastrophic event like an earthquake or something? Who knows what it could be? What if it's another COVID? It does not hurt so it to be prepared. But I want to go back to your comment, Aaron, on our military preparedness. Back when we wrote that paper, what kind of stimulated it, I was headed out to China Lake, and after I talked to Mike Reese, we knew Valero was shutting down. I thought, you know, I'm going out to China Lake, so I'm going to just ask the commander what his fuel situation is. Well, he couldn't tell me because it was classified. But then I said, what if you ran out of fuel and we couldn't make it in California? What would you do? He said, we'd fly it in. And he said, after a while, we'd move all of our support back to the Midwest and we'd operate out of there. He said it cost a lot of money. But he said that right now, that's our solution.
Mm.
Unbelievable.
Wow. And the fact that would even be a consideration is, but I mean, you can't do that with the Pacific Fleet. You know, the Midwest is no longer an option there.
Yeah, they fly in their fuel.
Mm.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. And I think again, we'll come back to you hear my my little frustration. We could prevent all this, but nobody wants to listen.
Yeah. Is there any? Do you have any indication through the legislature, any dawning awareness, any change? I mean, we haven't really pressed you on that for a couple months.
Yeah, we asked. I'm on a problem solvers caucus, and it's it's Democrats and Republicans, and we wrote a letter to the CEC asking them about their preparedness. How much fuel do we have on hand? What are they going to do, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we have yet, that letter went out last week, so we have yet to hear back. But at least we have, I would tell you this, some of my Democratic colleagues see the writing on the wall, and they're really concerned as well. So it's a nonpartisan issue right now.
Well, that's kind of great, because you were kind of, There was just a handful of you that were lone voices. I remember when we first asked you this, probably December, I guess, and you had said that, you know, privately the Democrats would agree that this was a problem, but publicly they wouldn't say anything because it was contrary to what the governor was putting out.
Well, they're now starting to realize, because they're hearing from their constituents, especially on the price. And affordability issues. So now they're really coming to fruition. It's coming to fruition that everything we had been saying and everything that I had been advocating is coming to fruition. Therefore, they went, oh, this is real. We probably should do something. So yes, they are. They're becoming very active.
Nice. So there's a little bit of a turn, and
yeah.
So I mean, I know we can't ever fully know, but let's pretend we got rid of the California Air Resources Board, CARB, that we talk about all the time for people who don't deal with regulation or don't live in California. But if we got rid of the California Air Resources Board, who is the big thumb on the scale for the anti-oil regulation in California, if they disappeared tomorrow, what does that do? How fast do we turn a corner?
Pretty damn fast, with the exception of getting the people back to do the work. But if you got rid of CARB, or at least, look, we don't need to get rid of some air regulations. Some regulations are good. We have to get rid of some elements in CARB, like cap and trade, because there's no economic incentive to stay in business in this state. They just take it all away.
Mm-hmm.
So you get rid of that, you get rid of some of the air regulations that are driving these people out of business. And I'll tell you what, you'll scream. It'll come back, and it will it will be a great economic benefit to the state. And jobs and no fuel shortage and even cleaner.
Well, and from the science perspective, you know, we've done shows for a very long time on the air regulation, and I mean, you'd have to be, even little kids know that the air above their head doesn't stay there forever. You know, it's part of the bigger air picture in the world. So the idea that we're crushing our industry in the state of California for air regulation when we're buying all our fuel from gross polluters overseas and we're ultimately all sharing the same air, how does that even square? You guys ever have those conversations? Are you ever forced to sit through those? Are they like the Brando meetings from Idiocracy?
No, but you're spot on. There's a jet stream that comes in here and pushes all that stuff out. And ultimately, there's a pretty big world out there. And as far as the greenhouse gas agenda, I don't know that it's ever been proven. So to me, as a scientist, I look at this and I see there's nothing wrong with trying to get cleaner burning, more efficient engines. There's
sure.
nothing wrong with that. We all want efficiency. But there is a point where economics play into this and health play into that. And you have to balance that. And to your point, we have a jet stream that comes in here and blows that stuff out of here. Let's just go back to work, folks. Well, you know what we should do, Aaron? Here's what we should do. So I'm a scientist. I've been in science for 40 years. Believe it or not, we will run out of oil and gas someday, right? I don't know, is that 100 years? Is that 150 years? Again, I come back to the high-speed rail. Why are we spending that money on high-speed rail when you could go into fusion and have fusion, nuclear, and hydrogen, all the power and gas in the world that we ever needed? And it's inevitable. Why are we spending money on a high-speed rail? It just drives me nuts. I'm sorry I keep bringing that up.
It's high-cost rail, by the way.
Yeah.
Congressman LaMalfa called it high-cost rail. Like, it never was called high-speed rail because it stopped being high-speed. What, like 5 minutes after they invented it, they realized it couldn't be high-speed? It was just going to be high-cost?
I wish the building would be high-speed. We'd get it behind us.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, yeah, no, we need alternative forms of energy. And I'm a proponent of, like I say, fusion and fission, which is nuclear. And we would eliminate a lot of our oil and gas needs. But we want to spend it on idiotic things like the high-speed rail and some of these social programs that are killing our state.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just it's terrifying and depressing. I did find the Brando clip from Idiocracy. Are you familiar with that, Stan?
No, I'm not.
Oh, that's so great. It's a really dumb movie, and it's from a long time ago, but it was kind of funny years ago. The guy that wrote it, it's kind of like a Dumb and Dumber movie. And the guy that wrote it, he actually posted on Twitter at the time that he didn't make it as a documentary. Like, it was never supposed to be a documentary, but so much of it was coming true. So tell me if this sounds a little bit like the California legislature meetings that you go to surrounding, like, say, regulatory environment for oil and gas.
Time. I'm pretty sure what's killing the crops is this Brando stuff.
But Brando's got what plants crave. It's got electrolytes.
So wait a minute. What you're saying is that you want us to put water on the crops?
Yes.
Water. Like out the toilet?
Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be out of the toilet, but yeah, that's the idea.
But Brando's got what plants crave.
It's got electrolytes.
Okay, look. The plants aren't growing, so I'm pretty sure that the Brando's not working. Now, I'm no botanist, but I do know that if you put water on plants, they grow.
Well, I've never seen no plants grow out of no toilet.
Hey, that's good. You sure you ain't the smartest guy in the world?
Yeah.
Okay, look, you want to solve this problem, I want to get my pardon, so why don't we just try it, okay? And not worry about what plants crave.
Brando's got what plants crave.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes.
What are electrolytes? Do you even know? It's what
they used to make Brondo.
Yeah, but why did they use them to make Brondo?
Because Brondo's got electrolytes.
That's Matt Judge, the creator of Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill.
Yeah, Brondo's like a sports drink in the movie. And, yeah.
Professor Mist just texted me, said United Airlines raised the rate 20%.
Oh, isn't that terrific?
Yeah.
Another Brondo meeting success.
Yeah.
I hate to say this, but we have to take a little break for the news so we can ponder the Brondo thing. I will post that on the website in case people haven't seen that before, because it's pretty instructive. We'll be right back with our guest, Stan Ellis.